We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 226, for November 17th, 2021. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we discuss the pros and cons between community college and four-year universities for both students and aspiring professors. The CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now.
Good morning. Welcome, everybody, to episode 226 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. I am stepping in for our normal host, Chris Webster, who is living his best life, traveling the United States, you know, enjoying the world that we all live in. Meanwhile, the rest of us are doing a podcast on cultural resource management archaeology. I'm joined with my colleagues here, Andrew, who's in California.
Hello, everybody.
Heather in California.
Hi, everyone.
And tuning in from the very far east, the furthest east you can go before you're west, Doug in Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
All right. So today we're going to continue on the previous conversation we were having about community colleges versus the four-year experience. I mean, going to college is one of the things that all archaeologists have in common. And we kind of got off track last time. And at a certain point, there was a Pepsi challenge about, you know, going into a conversation about the benefits of going to a community college versus a four-year. I went to a four-year college, and we can talk about that for a long time, right? I'm permanently scarred from it. But we have other guests who went to two-year community colleges. And I'll pass it over to Andrew, who can tell us all about the two-year experience at the community college.
Sure. So I thought we could talk, you know, about this two-year experience in terms of what it gets you, you know, as a CRM archaeologist, like where we're ultimately going to land, you know, as a CRM archaeologist. So the thought of going through the college system, even maybe kind of knowing what you want earlier on. So the community college system, I actually never went as a student. So, you know, I don't have that dirty community college, you know, aspect to my glorious academic career.
Hey.
Yeah, I know, which is, I think my joke right off the bat, you know, goes with the sort of the angle that a lot of people take on community college. It's somehow it's secondary. Somehow it's a consolation prize. You know, I see that both with students and with faculty. If you get a full-time job in the community college world, it's like, oh, well, maybe next time in the four-year system. You know, I see that again and again and one more time. And as we all know, that kind of thing is just not true. It's predicated on a very old ideology that never really was.
Meanwhile, community college professors on a whole as full-time staff very often can get paid more.
That's actually true as well. And that's actually, man, this just brings up so many topics, like even in the college world, you know, what they tell you in terms of pay. Nobody ever brings that up. That, yes, the pay of community college versus the 4 years is basically the same. You know, there's a lot of variation there that we could talk about at another time. But it's not like you get paid nothing at the community college level and then you're a millionaire, you know, at the 4 year world. It's vaguely similar.
Well, and also another huge difference, too, because I'm talking to a lot of my students who are doing the adjunct thing. It's not like the adjunct thing. You're actually an instructor that's hired by the institution with benefits and a salary and, you know, a contract that's more than the next quarter or whatever. So you're not necessarily in the same situation as adjunct. So that's another benefit, too, to folks out there who are thinking about a PhD or something and they've been, you know, fed the Kool-Aid for a long time. That, you know, you must get tenure track, otherwise it's not worth it to get a PhD. This is definitely a huge thing that a lot of your professors are not really going to mention because of what Andrew is talking about. They're not going to consider it the same thing. They a lot of times don't count it as success if you go to the community college. But like given the odds of you getting a tenure track job, it's an absolute success.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, I will add, my job actually was tenure track. There is a tenure system at the community college level as well, which, you know, maybe a lot of people don't know. It's funny like that, because you go through the whole thing. You have things you have to do at certain years. Of course, it's not nearly as harsh as the 4-year world in terms of like research and that kind of thing. But it still is there. So I got tenure, you know, after I think 4 or 5 years, something like that. So that's how it works.
That's awesome.
Just to add to that, because I didn't ever publish it, but a while ago, I pulled the pay for different universities that have archaeology/anthropology programs. And actually, in terms of money, because when you have to do that, you have to look at cost of living at the places. But like the really prestigious places in anthropology, so you're looking at like Harvard, Berkeley, Stanford, Chicago, like those professors, when you compare them to most state schools, even though on paper they're making more money, they're actually like losing money. Like Bill's probably the poorest out of all of us on this podcast. Like, we really should be like chipping in and sending him money every once in a while so he can participate. Because I mean, he's living in the, well, I'm pretty sure you're not living in the Bay Area, but like that area of California, yeah. Bill's pretty much screwed in terms of. Well, I love you
thinking of that. Because yes, money is one of my favorite gifts to receive, but not to give, to receive. So if you really want to chip in, please do.
Yeah,
so, I mean, fund me page for Bill
with no closing date,
right? These points are so true, and I swear, I think just nobody knows these sorts of things. You know, I mean, I see social media posts all the time of people looking to get jobs, people with PhDs looking to get jobs, and there was one recently that said like, I applied to a community college, and they got all these responses of like, that's okay, you'll be all right somehow.
It's not a shoe-in either, man, because I got turned down by more community college when I was looking for a tenure track job than other state universities.
We had a total academic. I will say our last open tenure track anthropology position had 100 applicants who passed minimum qualifications.
Yeah.
That's how tough these jobs are to get.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't even get interviews with the community colleges.
Right. And it just depends. And this gets into, how we cast ourselves in these kind of things as professionals. You know, what we learn, we all know that like certain schools just have certain ways of doing things, you know, and you just might not fit. I mean, I experienced that first and foremost at places me like Bill that I didn't get anything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's I'm glad Doug mentioned the livability, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm starting to really ask folks about this livability question. You know, I kind of started from that perspective of, you know, what kind of role do you want this to play in your life? And I mean, this is something that I thought about a lot when I was doing cultural resources and hearing a lot of people freak out over like everything, freak out over, you know, having to turn in $17 a per diem and freak out over like, you know, having to drive back and forth to the work site. And, you know, just a lot of different things that were going on. And it seemed like a lot of that was coming from a place of like scarcity and fear and like, you know, just a inability to empower oneself or to reevaluate what you thought that you were supposed to get out of this job. And so I start asking folks, you know, like, well, why do you want to get a PhD? What role is this going to play in your life? What role will getting a tenure track job play in your life? And mm-hmm. so many times people are like, oh, well, it's going to give me, you know, stability and benefits and a higher wage. And I'm like, you know what? If you're really good at CRM, you can find that same level of stability, because in academia, you actually don't really have stability. Like, you don't know if they're going to get rid of tenure. You don't know if your wages are going to change. You don't know if the state's going to collapse and you don't get paid, right? The same way that you don't necessarily know if that's going to happen in CRM. I feel like, and also just like the pressure and the context of doing this kind of work is different than CRM. And it's really a lot of times more suitable to folks' lives to do cultural resources, where they get to, you know, go to their house when they're done and they get to be there, that, you know, when they wake up in the morning, all they have to do is just drive to work and start doing the work, right? Rather than like wake up in the morning and the work has already been waiting for you all night. and you have to handle it before you drive, and then you get to work and you handle more work, and then it follows you home. And 7 days a week, I'm not joking, man, 7 days a week I work. So you don't always do that in cultural resources at all levels.
I would say that definitely is the case in CRM also, but we can talk about that later. But I think in certain levels, you're absolutely correct. Doug?
Well, I did I ran the numbers. This was years ago. It's probably gotten worse because like when you take into account, so this is like an average. So it was your average student loan debt and cost of going to a university and like, you know, average salary of professors and average salary of what you were getting in CRM and stuff. So, you know, it's not perfect, but like it really depends. The people who do the best in CRM will make way more than the people who I hate the phrase like this, but the worst, and this is only in money wise, people working at university, and it's shrinking a lot because if you think about CRM, you really only need a master's, and you could probably get by with a BA depending on the state, and you know, as long as you're not having to do as much federal stuff, yada yada, stuff like that. But you know, if people take out like 40 or 50,000 in student loans and stuff, or you know, 100,000 to get a PhD, you're not going to make that money back in your higher salary at a lot of academic jobs. Like, and it's getting worse because you know, more people coming out with more debt, and there's many fewer jobs. It's a much higher risk. Like, on average, you probably will make a little bit more if you were, say, a professor, than if you went into the highest levels of CRM, but it's 20%. 20% of people who have a PhD in archaeology/anthropology actually go into get a permanent-ish job in academia. So like it's a huge trade-off. So you, when you look at actually the money and stuff, CRM's it's more guaranteed money. Yes. It's less risk, and you can make, you know, if I were to look at this actually now, because I did these numbers maybe 8 years ago, I'd almost say your odds are better. You'll make more money in CRM. And I think it's getting to the point where not just like if you struck the lottery and win and get the right place in academia, it's now almost becoming that actually CRM, again, if you can make it past tech level and work your way up and you last long enough, you can pretty much make as much or more money over your career doing that than you would doing academia.
Right. And I would just echo Bill's point earlier about the academic jobs are not as secure as everyone thinks. It's not like, oh, you have tenure. You just can just sit down and do nothing and think about artifacts. It's like, no, it's like they don't realize the fine line of some of this. Like, oh, maybe your department just got closed, you know, or guess what? The students aren't taking your classes. So we got to slim this down. Sorry, man.
Yeah.
They just closed basically three departments here in the UK are being shut down right now.
Good ones, too.
Yeah, it's making big news.
I know there's at least a couple in the States, and even during good years. What was it, Florida State, about 10 years ago? No, well, okay, more 2006 or something. Even before the Great Recession, like they decided they're going to close down their anthropology program, and that was in the good years.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, this actually goes back to, I remember, Bill, when we were talking about touching on unionization of, and that's a whole other topic. But one thing that Bill had brought up, a really good point, is that when, you know, academia can be in some ways very much like a union, where you can be working your butt off, you can be the best professor there, you can be the one that all the students want to take their classes, and yet you're still stuck within a certain amount of money that you're making because of the way that pay fee, you know, pay schedule is structured when it comes to academia. In some kind, I'm not sure if all universities are like that. Where CRM, it's not a given. I mean, and you were talking about like your job never ending. I am literally, and that is no exaggeration, I'm pulling like a 12-hour day is an easy day for me right now, just because of the way our business is and it's so crazy busy. And also because the skill set that I've developed over time and the ones that others have not has just made it so that now there are certain things that only a few of us can do. And so I'm between 12 and 15 hours a day. And then I'm working on the weekends too. It's just, it happens in every sector. But when it comes to CRM, it's not a given. You guys, you know, people need to understand you have to build your skill set. It's not just about, and I think a lot of people have that misconception where, okay, I'm going to go in, I'm going to be a tech and I'm going to work hard, or I'm just going to show up and it's just, and I'll work hard and I'll do my thing when I'm there. But on the same trajectory, I'm just going to keep working towards doing what I'm doing well, instead of continuing to try to improve your skill set and make yourself more marketable. I'm just going to go and put in the time. And no job works like that, typically.
Right.
I mean, you have nepotism and all that kind of baloney. Right. But no, I mean, unions work that way. But then you have to wait a long period. You have certain thresholds time-wise that you have to meet.
Yeah.
In CRM, it is on you. And if you want to... you want to work hard and build your skill set and make yourself marketable and make yourself, you know, attractive to, and not, nobody's irreplaceable, but definitely valuable in a company. That's where you're going to make money. It does not happen by accident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, you know, it does seem like more people need to recognize that they're empowered to take more control over things, and that, you know, the academic job market is beyond capricious. However, you can definitely construct a skill set of valuable abilities that a lot of different companies will want, and that'll increase your odds and make it more likely that you continue doing archaeology. But I think we're going to end this segment right here, and we'll start after the break with the next segment.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right, welcome back to the next segment of episode 226 of the Cultural Resource Management Archaeology Podcast. You know, we were talking about, you know, leveraging what you get from your university experience to get these jobs in cultural resources or academia. But I kind of want to talk a little bit more about the cost value ratio, right? Like how much you spend on your education versus how much you get out of it. So, you know, one of the things that's amazing about community college system is that even though it's 2 years, you spend much less on average for those 2 years than you would if you went to a 4-year school. So I'm going to pass this over to Doug right now because he has some numbers on, you know, how much it costs generally to go to a community college versus a 4-year.
Yeah. So that was back when I was looking at average costs for different archaeology degrees. And of course, everything's just so much higher than what it was when I did this, you know, 7-8 years ago. But it's a bit tough because a lot of people, like a lot of universities, the majority of students don't pay the sticker price. Like they, you know, especially when you go to like those liberal arts and they're like, oh, it's $50,000 a year. They usually like give people all sorts of bits of money. And it's actually a bit of a marketing thing where, you know, how like some people will put up their prices on, I don't know, pillows or whatever, but they always are running sales. They're always having some sort of sale going on. And so, but you feel like you've got, you know, a good deal out of it. So like when you go to that, you know, liberal arts, very private, expensive school and, you know, the sticker price is like 50,000 and you're only paying like 15,000, you feel like you've gotten like this massive deal when in reality, most everyone else is paying that as well. So it's a bit tough, but when you look at it, for the most part, the cost for community college beats out not just like any of the privates. All the privates are pretty much you're gone on that, but pretty much almost all public 4-year. And it'll depend a bit, you know, it's hugely variable on your circumstances. So like different states or different ways. New Mexico used to have still has the lottery scholarship that used to cover all your tuition. Now it only covers like half of it. So there's different things like that. But easily, if you're having to pay for your university, community college blows it out of the water. And it also depends. Certain community colleges, depending where you live, if you go locally, it's free. I ended up in high school, they had a deal where you could take community college courses and it would both count for high school and then you got the university credit for it. So I knocked out a full semester of university for free by being able to do it just at my local community college because it was free to local residents and there was a great deal. So, I mean, there's pretty much no – if we're doing the Pepsi challenge, automatically community college is going to – the average community college is going to blow out of water the average public university that's subsidized. And there's no – not even close to competition on the private.
Right. The cost in the community college world just always wins because it's basically about $40 a unit. And if you think a typical class is 3 units, so it's about $120 per class. And then it depends on how many you take per semester, you know, so that's what you're looking at. And of course, there'll be a handful of other fees. But yeah, you can't even get close. In comparison, you know, we're going to have the UC system, which will be about $16,000 a year. The Cal State system, which is about $8,000. And then community college, depending on how many classes, you know, maybe $2,000 a year. Maybe mm-hmm. It just depends. But yes, price wise, there's no comparison.
Yeah. One of the things that actually keeps me wanting to stay in the state of California, even though it's so expensive, is the fact that the college system, if I can make it for my kids, I could actually end up paying for college for my kids, which is amazing, right? They could finish college with no student loan debt. And, you know, we're trying to, I got two kids. They're both, my son's in middle school right now. He's in seventh grade. So I got a little bit of time, but not as much as many people would think. And just the amount of savings, because I've been doing archaeology for so long, is not big enough for me to be able to pay for tuition in most states. So kind of our thing is either they get a full ride to one of the state or University of California's or the California State Universities, or they go to community college because on average, it's like $1,300 a semester to go to community college in California, which is some of the lowest in the United States. And then you're right, Andrew, sometimes some programs you qualify and you can actually go for free, but you can get those first 2 years out. And then if they transfer even to a place like Berkeley, like the University of California, Berkeley takes half of their incoming freshmen from the community college system. Mm-hmm. So if they go to Berkeley, then it's about $7,400 a semester or $7,000 a semester. Well, that's what it is right now, right? So it'll probably be up to $8,000. What's crazy is we probably actually could try to save over the next few years for my kids to go and cover the tuition at that rate. But there's no way we could cover 4 years of that money, right? Like we don't have that much cash, but there's a total chance that they could do it if they went community college through to 4 years. So that's actually literally our plan for our kids. If they don't get a free ride somewhere, then that's the plan.
Right. Us too. Same plan. And I tell all my students, I mean, I've literally had hundreds of students, you know, at this point that have done exactly this. They went to community college for the first 2 years, you know, and then you save so much money that you can transfer to a Cal State or a UC, you know, and then I always tell them in terms of college debt, I'm like, just be in debt for car money. Don't be in debt for house money. You know, so it's like if you come out and you're in debt for the same price as a really, really well decked out Honda Civic, that's okay. you can pay that off, you know, but not $120,000 for the down payment of a house. No, it ain't worth it for an anthro degree.
Yeah. And well, it ain't worth it really for any degree except for like a PhD or, another grad degree or a JD or something like that, that you're going to go on. Like you're going to go into a career where you cannot be a medical doctor without a medical degree. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you cannot be a university professor without a PhD.
Exactly.
If you, the one thing you want to do requires that absolutely, then you that's what we're doing. Like you mm-hmm. pretty much have to do that. However, I would even suggest folks to go to other countries to get their degree, because you can get a PhD, you know, in like Denmark, where I was at, for even out of countries, if you can get accepted, it's like, you know, way cheaper than most other universities. So if you're mm-hmm. not going to get a full tuition waiver and payment and be able to, you know, work a part-time job, yeah. then you probably should look at a whole nother country if you're going to go for a PhD.
Yeah.
I agree on that. You just have to be careful, because people, you know, we do have people that apply for jobs with degrees from other countries, and it PhDs are great. They're not necessarily required in CRM, and it really depends on what your role is going to be. In fact, sometimes a PhD gets a second kind of a side eye look, because mm-hmm. are they focused mm-hmm. more on academia than they are on, and do they, are they willing to look at all the varied aspects of CRM, the regulatory, the business side, those types of things? And then the other part is that, you know, the further away that you move away to do your work for your PhD, if you're in Europe, the less connected you are to the US, to regional knowledge when it comes to archaeology. And so, you know, we have a lot of people that will apply and they've gotten their degrees in other countries. And so, you know, they know everything about Scottish archaeology or Danish mm-hmm. archaeology, but it's very hard for them then to just kind of move right into CRM, because it's different. It's very different. And regional experience and regional knowledge is important. I think as far as getting back to the community college versus four-year Pepsi challenge, the first 2 years are usually you're just building up your GE credits, right? So, you know, I really think it's kind of it's a waste of money in many ways to be using, you know, these GE credits and to be building those classes at a four-year university if you don't have a ride and all that kind of thing. In where I live in the area, both my kids could have gone to or could go to community college completely free. If they went to high school here and they choose to go to the community college here in this area, they get it for free. They don't pay for it. So just much like what Doug is saying, and a lot of people actually are taking these classes and there's dual credit. So, you know, that's great. That's an extra plus. But then also if they choose to stay in the area, which a lot of areas are now starting to do this, it's starting right. to spread across California. I think some of it has to do with wanting to provide that service to the community. I think the other part is that people want to keep the young people in town, right? So the more they're mm-hmm. invested and the more time they spend at university here, you know, in their local community, mm-hmm. the more apt they are to come back after they finish their four-year degree.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, it's hard to convince people to move to California is the thing, because of the yeah. sticker shock, but it's yeah. easier to provide a pathway for someone in California to stay yeah. here.
Yep.
Exactly. Right. And I would also add, I think sometimes people think if they go to community college that the professors themselves will be somehow secondary. And I just want to, you know, talk from no. my own experience and say that actually, if you think about it, we've had like 40 years of way too many PhDs. So what you get is top talent across the entire board. Like I said, our last full-time gig had 100 people who applied, you know, so if you go to a community college, it doesn't mean you get like some second rate anthro person who doesn't know stuff. It means like jobs are at a premium. So you get good quality no matter what. So for the consumer, it's actually really great.
And they're not stifled by this requirement. Although, you know, it doesn't mean that they're not keeping, you know, the professors aren't keeping their toe in research and continuing to publish, but they don't have like this overwhelming pressure to publish or perish like you do in R1 school. You don't have this overwhelming pressure to be bringing in grants and to be funded and have your research funded. So you're not constantly being pulled away in all these other tasks, and you can really focus on teaching and making sure that your students are engaged, that they're learning practical, not just, you know, being filled with information, but actually knowing how to practice that information.
Yes. And we're also hired because of our ability to teach. Like that is the number one thing they look for in a community college. So often I see researchers with their PhD and they think they're going to get they're like, oh, well, I guess I'll try for community college. It's like, dude, you're never going to make it. because you don't have, it's true, because it's two different castings. Yes. You want to think of it as two different, it's two different strengths, you know, 4 year versus community college, both PhDs, but different strengths. So like, I see these people who are just like, well, I couldn't make it in the 4 year world, so I'll just take the consolation prize. It's like, you're not going to get the consolation prize. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, you know, talking about hiring too, maybe you can fill in a little bit. Is it based on actual measurements that you can look at on paper, or is it magical politics and emotions like it is in, you know, actual academia? Because in academia, there's like, you know, they fall back on this thing called best fit, which allows them to basically use magic as the criteria of why they're choosing a candidate.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Everybody who applies, that you said something about 100 and something. So all 100 of those candidates all have a PhD. They all have a dissertation. Yep. They all have TA'd. They've all taught. Yep. They've all, you know, got some grants. They've all done research. They have articles and all that stuff, right? So it's like, you know, when everybody shows up to the table, are you actually looking at the reviews from students and like innovative ways in the classroom that people have connected topics and like the way they teach and everything? Or is it like here where it can be a weird popularity contest with like back behind the scenes politics that come out of nowhere, and then magically you've got someone chosen? Like, I have no idea what kind of craziness they had to do to get me here at Berkeley, but I know that it wasn't just purely based on like the qualifications that were in the job posting, because everybody who interviewed for the job had that.
Yeah, exactly. No, actually, I've been through many, many hirings because I was department chair for years and years. And I can say absolutely that the hirings are absolutely professional. Like, they go through, we take it real seriously. You know, there's an entire group of people, a hiring committee for each job. Yeah. And we read all of the applications, and then we whittle it down. We don't have like a final four. We have like a final like 12, you know, or 15 who finally get invited to the school. Then they have to do an hour long, like not a presentation of their research. So many people get this wrong. It's like they want to teach for an hour, and then we watch them. So it is a very heavy process. It is not a backdoor old boys network by any means. Like, it's I really like it how it is. It's very fair, and we, in my experience, we do get the top candidate. Like, it's really great.
I would think training up would be good. Like, you have an adjunct, right, that has proven themselves and is really good as already, I mean, you, they're a known entity, right?
Yeah.
To me, it seems like it would be practical to start people off as adjunct. And now, this doesn't mean you're going to like turn your head to, or you're not going to consider people that are coming in fresh, but do you look at adjuncts? I would think that would be a really good idea.
There are certain rules in the hiring process where adjuncts, like a certain percentage of the interviews have to go to adjuncts, because we're not there to, you know, adjuncts have such a difficult time anyways, and they just get screwed so badly anyways. At very least, we can like give them, you know, a job interview. So, and I will say in the past, that's very common where adjuncts definitely ultimately get a full-time job. Obviously not every time just because of the numbers, but that is a common route.
It's good to hear all that stuff. I mean, I don't know. Mostly, I think our audience is folks that are in cultural resources.
Right.
But this is turning into the kind of episode that folks who are in graduate school really need to listen to. Mm-hmm. So we're at time on this segment, but we're going to close it down, and then we'll come back with another segment on the same topic.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
All right, folks, we're back with the final segment of episode 226. We've talked about the cost benefit and, you know, what you get when you learn, or when you learn at a community college from skilled instructors who are, you know, valued for their teaching specifically. But now I want to talk a little bit about the value, how you transfer that value, what you learn in the community college system, how that can apply and help you with a job in archaeology. So, I mean, I guess I'll just pass it over to the panel, especially folks who have gone to community college. How do you rate your experience there as far as like how suitable it was to helping you with your career?
Yeah, Heather, how do you rate your experience?
Well, other than one of the professors,
I know how I rate my experience of going to a 4-year. So I figure I'd let the positive, we'll let the good news go first. Okay.
So I am so grateful. I mean, I was a returning student. This is a second career for me. And so I was looking for a place and actually just kind of putting my toe in the water and looking for a place where I could still be a mom and, you know, flexible schedule. You could do evening classes. That was why I initially went to community college. Plus it was cheaper, right? But after having had that experience and then having the experience then, of course, of getting the 4-year degree at a 4-year university and then going on to graduate school, I am so grateful that I took that route. Just looking at those that didn't take that route, they were entrenched. So the environment of a community college versus a 4-year is vastly different. It's almost like community college for archaeology is almost like a vocational college. And I mean, at least where I went. And, you know, Andrew, who was my professor, one of them, he made it that way. So you were really getting some practical experience where, you know, you just don't get that in a 4-year university, or at least most of them. And I actually I really think that, and we can talk about this model later, but I really do, you know, on another podcast, I think a vocational model would be excellent for archaeology. But anyway, so community college allows you, just for all the reasons that we've said before, it allows the professors that flexibility, and they're not just like bogged down with this concept of teaching stuff that really doesn't matter when it comes to CRM or when it comes to archaeology.
Yeah.
The world. Yeah. Right. And so for me as a community college graduate, you know, I got that practical experience of how to, you know, put archaeology and really, you know, get in the ground. And I didn't even have to go to a field school because one of my classes was a field school over multiple semesters. Every single semester had a field school component to it. And it actually slowed things down. Let's say you go to a field school. It's a 3-week field school. You're having to learn everything. It is a crash course in all these practical lessons, where if you're doing it over a semester and each one is focused, which is the way it is where I went, is, you know, you have a field component, you have an excavation component, you have a lab component. Field meaning like you do a lot of, you know, survey, that sort of thing. Then you have excavation component, and then you have the lab component. Was huge because really we're able to just soak it all up and really understand it. And it was so much more, I don't know, it was a more complex way of looking at these things instead of just saying, oh, okay, spending one day on how to use a compass. You're just not going to retain that.
Right. I always tell the students, we have the luxury of time, you know, which you don't get once you get into the real world, like CRM or something. So it's good for us, you know.
Yeah, I agree with some of the stuff that was said here. I can talk about my own undergrad experience at a 4-year school. I went to Boise State. I'm from Idaho. My parents went to Boise State. It was the local school, and either I was going to join the Navy or I was going to go to Boise State. So that's just where I started. And it wasn't until I was already in college that I finally realized that I should just switch to anthropology so that I can go into archaeology, what I'd always wanted to do, but I didn't know how to get there. We've talked about that before on the podcast, but I wrote a blog post a while ago. I don't even know how long ago this was, 2018, about which classes actually helped my career in cultural resources, and talking about, you know, classes where I learned anything that I would ever use in CRM. It was pretty low at, you know, the undergrad level, extremely low. It wasn't until I started going for my master's or my PhD that I started to take any classes where I'd learn anything that I actually used in cultural resources or in my career. And so as someone who went to a 4-year school, I absolutely realized that, you know, there's a huge amount of waste that goes into, you know, almost all of the levels. It's not just the stuff that you're learning in the anthrop classes. It's the fact that you're taking a whole bunch of other classes. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't take intro to theater, but I definitely think that if we're going to take intro to theater, we might want to think about, you know, like managing a stage act or managing performers or scheduling people or like figuring out anything that we would ever use in the real world from these kind of things, rather than just reading old tragedies from Greece, you know, that are 2,000 years old. Like, I mean, I'm okay with us taking these classes and this other stuff that doesn't necessarily apply exactly to our career, as long as it's taught in such a way that you get a kernel of something that you can use later on in the future. And I feel like when it comes to all 4-year schools and everything, that's like the big hole. That's the thing that's missing in every way, that the courses aren't designed towards preparing you to do really anything. They're just designed for you to learn what the professor already knows. In my experience as an undergrad at Boise State, that was, I had one professor that was actually engaged in any way in me as a person and as someone who wants to be an archaeologist or anything. And the rest of the people just kind of wrote me off as just another person sitting in a seat, and they just sat there talking and talking. I mean, this was the 90s. And so they just talked all about the stuff that they knew as if they were these, you know, super high elite, you know, geniuses or whatever. And not a single shred of any of that stuff, even in things like, you know, Indians of North America, not a single shred of that actually is coming informed from Native people that could help you learn anything about how to interact as an archaeologist with Native people. It was just like going through the Smithsonian Book of Cultures of the United States or North America and just talking about them. And then we had quizzes about it, right? I mean, it was just an extension of high school. And so I see that so much in the, you know, R1 schools that it's kind of crazy, you know, to just look and see that everyone's looking towards these R1 schools as the people who are thinking up the ideas and producing it all. But really, it's kind of coming from this constrained worldview that you shall read a whole lot and then dig some units and write a bunch of like peer-reviewed journal articles and, you know, books from academic presses. And that is your measurement of what you're doing. And that as long as you're doing that kind of stuff, you can just kind of do whatever you want. You can teach these classes where for, you know, a month and a half, everybody just reads these articles, whatever you feel like talking in class. And then you have this midterm that's this, you know, 20-page thing. There's no discussion about grammar or anything else, where you're just kind of supposed to like regurgitate big chunks of stuff that you already heard, along with a couple of ideas that you feel are unique. And then the professor, at the whim of their own thing, or the TAs or whatever, they just kind of judge you and evaluate you on that one essay. And then it's time to move on to the next one. So you spend, you know, 4 months, you write 40 pages of something, and you spend dozens of hours in the classroom. And at the end of it, not a single shred of that is going to help you, you know, as a manager of Best Buy or working for the Department of Transportation or as a cultural resource management archaeologist.
Yeah. I'll say, I mean, board here, Bill. You're falling on your sword here, Bill.
I was actually going to say,
that's not the way my classes are, right? Like, that's not the way my classes are, because I actually spent time reflexively thinking about my experience as a student and spent time in cultural resources. And I only try to teach the kind of stuff that people need to get a job.
You're unique. Right.
I mean, that's pretty much the only thing I even in my class. The whole thing is set up to simulate the kind of stuff you're going to do once you leave this classroom, to learn a couple of things, including softwares and other stuff that we never talk about, and also budgeting and thinking about advocating for the fact that you should deserve a wage, right? Thinking about that you pay yourself. Like, what's missing from every graduate student's grant application? Paying themselves. They almost never give themselves any money to pay themselves. And the grants a lot of times have stipulations on you even paying yourself for anything. What kind of world is that? Like, who wants to be a professional that's working for free?
It's for pure research, okay, Bill? Like, there is, but there's not,
when you work for a state organization, there is no pure research, right?
I know.
We serve at the whim of the state of California's government, right?
You know, it's good that I'm here to actually defend the 4-year world from Bill. So I will say I can think of a couple things that I thought the 4-year was good at, like, because it's so research heavy. As a student, you can work in like a research lab, you know, and you don't have that much. There's not as many opportunities at the community college level. There's just not going to be, you know, to work in. Yeah, so that actually.
So there's one thing to working in a lab where you're actually going to analyze artifacts and learn how to do something in a way that you can use in the field, versus being free student labor that just counts flakes for an entire semester and does counts nothing and that can be at, you know, make one table on microliths. That's all you do for 6 months, so that a professor and the grad students can write an article based on your counts.
Yeah. No analysis.
And that's an absolute reality that a lot of undergrads are living with. They think that they're getting lab experience by just doing the hard, heavy lifting of counting these nuanced, you know, artifacts that someone else gets all the benefit from the end result.
Right.
And there's actually a lot of opportunities to do that free labor as well, I'd say. Mm-hmm. Like, I know you're saying there's more chances to be exploited in the 4-year, but I mean, those were actually really hard to come by, at least at the university I went to. And they were even more exploitative in that they were volunteer and you couldn't actually get credit for it. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, I mean, I think it comes down definitely to the university, but I'm not going to say that that's much of an advantage to a 4-year.
I don't know, man. I mean, two of the universities I went to both had archaeological information centers, you know, and you could work there and get paid. And I learned a lot in the information center world of, you know, doing the phase one stuff and, you know, bringing out the maps, looking at the maps, all that. So I thought that was actually really, really good experience. And I actually did get paid doing that at those times. Yeah,
so that stuff was available. However, I had to work 40 hours a week almost when I was an undergrad, right? So like I had 30 to 40 hours a week of work. I could not take these opportunities to count flakes for free or for, you know, $500 a semester. Like that was not actually an option. What you're talking about of breaking the pieces of the field school and then integrating that into several different classes and then teaching that across four semesters. I mean, you're going to get way more experience and more understanding about how archaeology works if you do it that way.
Oh yeah. There's miles more depth.
Yeah. Yeah. Then forcing a student to kind of sacrifice their only time to feed themselves to work in these little labs.
Right. I really don't understand this concept. You see it a lot on the social media, talk boards, whatever, where people are saying that CRM is, you know, exploitive and that, you know, it's the big guy that makes all the money. And there's this like hate on for CRM when in actuality, that's what's happening in academia. That, I mean, you are literally working for free and then, you know, you really don't get a whole lot of credit for it. I mean, at least some of the work that I did in graduate school, you know, you felt like you had this stature because you're, you know, or some people did because you're doing this lab work for this important professor or whatever. And when in actuality, you're just free labor. That's all it is. And, you know, I don't understand that concept. And we do need to shift it. I mean, just like Bill was saying, is that academia has gotten away with this kind of mindset for a long period, this elitist mindset for a long period of time. And I think people are starting to wake up.
Well, I mean, I think it's like a mathematical pragmatism, right? If every single car is $30,000 and your rent that you share with one other roommate is $1,200 a piece, and you've got to work 40 hours a week driving Uber and at Subway or Starbucks to afford just to even live, where are you going to fit in the cash and time to go to college, right? Like if you go to college, then where are you going to live? In your car? Or are you going to get rid of the car so that you can live to go to college? Like those are the kind of pragmatic things that everyone in the United States is thinking about if they're in their teens or 20s and in families like, you know, my family, we're trying to figure this out. That's where staying the course is not really a choice anymore.
Then the answer for people are, they think, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll just keep on. I mean, I saw it all the time when I was in graduate school, where you had people that were taking on debt, not just to get educated, they were taking on debt to live. They were buying nice cars. I mean, there's a lot of irresponsible loans out there. You know, now there's this, well, I shouldn't even have to work if I'm going to be able to focus on my studies. And so now it's not just the education they're paying for everything else. And that's what is inflating the amount of money that people owe.
Yeah, but I mean, in a place like Denmark, that's possible, right? Because you pay a 90% tax on every single car. So that $30,000 car is like, you know, 60-something thousand. And every single person collects the taxes or pays taxes because there's fewer loopholes and ways to get out. That's how students get paid to go to college in those places. Unless we want to do that here, then we got to make those trade-offs. Like, that's the only thing.
But then you're paying $60,000 for the, I don't know, it's just shifting money around. You're paying $60,000 now for a car where you could pay $20,000 for a car.
Well, no, you're paying $60,000 for a lazy river. I mean, there's universities that have crazy, like LSU has a lazy river in the shape of LSU. What? Yeah, that's what happened. That's where university's gone. As soon as, you know, 70s and 80s, and basically they started cutting funding. You know, to be fair, most education is interchangeable in the sense that you could teach. There's only so many ways you could teach how to add 2 + 2, and the difference really makes is when you get like a good experience, or you have a really good professor or something who takes interest and helps you along. And, you know, it's that sort of experience that teaches you stuff. But essentially what's happened at higher education and, you know, mainly in the United States and Canada, but it's now, it's come to the UK and stuff, is that's not enough, like, just to say you got a good education. Like, universities have to somehow, like, try to convince students to come over. So you either do that because you're some elite university and don't let everyone in, and there's only a couple of universities that can pull it off, and everyone else is like, okay, well, if we can't compete on, like, giving a better education, we'll compete on, you know, amenities, like the dorms. If you look at modern dorms at universities, they've gone from, like, halls where basically semi-military barrack style, cheaply made, like, you could hear every, like, three doors down because, like, it's a single course of bricks, everything like that, to now students, almost every student has, like, a apartment style dorm, or, you know, it's not big halls, it's like these massive beautiful amenities and stuff, and that's how they bring in students, and it's driving up costs, but it works. It's a system that works. Is you're paying for all the flash, or you're paying for the name. So, like going to Harvard, you're that means nothing. You're basically paying for a name to say that you're smart, and the quality of teaching you're going to get there is going to be piss poor. But it doesn't matter because
well, we say that because we didn't go to Harvard, right? So
no, I know people have gone to Harvard and other universities, and they say that teaching is, because the professors don't care and they don't need to care. Yep. People are happy enough just to be at Harvard. No one's going to complain about the quality of education they're getting from Harvard, because you're not paying for education. You're paying for a brand, and you're paying to be branded as smart or successful or whatever, and that's all you're doing. And so there's a couple of universities that do that, and there's a couple of, and a lot of universities now are just competing on, like, you know, can we attract 18-year-olds with flashy stuff? And of course you can, because they're 18 and you don't know any better. And yeah, okay, so you start taking out student loans, but it's not a mental, like, when you start taking out a loan, you don't understand how much you're paying back until you start paying it back. And it's quite easy. And people are just like, oh, yeah, you know, I'll take out a loan and then I'll make a lot of money later and it'll be no problem, without understanding compounding interest. And that, like, man, as soon as you hit over, like, $100,000 in loans, that's basically it. Like, you're never
Right.
Yeah. You know, and they're paying for a brand, but what's sad is they pay for this brand and they have no skills to show for it.
Yep.
Well, bingo. Yeah. Well, I go ahead, Heather.
I was just going to say bingo. That's it.
No, I mean, the one thing that I want folks that they're listening to this is to think that there's more than one way, right? Like, there's more than one way for you to get to where you want to be as an archaeologist.
Yes.
You can definitely follow the road that's already been worn by all of us on this podcast. We all went to college. Mm-hmm. We all continued on. We all got graduate degrees. We're all, you know, still moving forward in this direction, doing that same thing that we've already done. But I feel like, you know, we're all a little bit older and that things have changed to the point where you might want to start thinking about these other diverse strategies, right? Of incorporating community college with a 4-year school so that you can get the official degree, and workplace occupational learning,
yes,
you know, in the workplace, partnering, job shadowing, and all that other stuff. Find these opportunities. And if they don't exist, I mean, we're getting to the point where a lot of companies are actually much more flexible and open to having job shadows and interns and other stuff.
Yes.
So that you can get that kind of occupational training. And then when it comes to master, you know, we've talked about graduate school too. When it's time to get a master's, finding an efficient and effective and economically, you know, suitable way for you to get to where you want to be. So, you know, that's really what this is all about. Not necessarily about all of us hanging out on the lazy river or paying Bill as much money as we possibly can so that I can teach stuff about broken ceramics, you know. But the whole goal is for folks to get the knowledge that they can build their own pathway, because that's really what you're going to have to do. You can't necessarily follow what others have already done.
Goodbye.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. So yeah, I appreciate everyone listening today, to all the listeners here and the folks here on the panel. And then what does Chris always say? He says he'll see you in the field, but I think I'll just see you here on the podcast next time. Take care.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
See you later.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
All right, Doug. I think you're done, my friend.
Yeah, I got in early, man. It's either super late or super early. There's not like, you know, we got to keep that alive. But I got done, man.
Each recording, man, my cheeks hurt because I just start laughing so hard at when you're about, I don't know, man, it's just crazy. It never gets old to me. Never gets old.
I'm glad, man. I'm glad.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.